Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Burma's president makes first trip to Europe. The BBC World Service and Voice of America transmissions to East and Southeast Asia are being jammed by the Chinese, but not Chinese programming, but rather English. And finally, have you ever thought about traveling somewhere and taking a course at the same time? Well, two guys in Singapore are going to be offering a photography course that involves travel. So stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Burma's President Thein Sein has begun his first trip to Europe, stopping in Norway on the first leg of his trip that will also take him to Finland, Austria, Belgium, and Italy. Thein Sein has headed straight to the country that was once Burma's most vocal critics. We have this report from Bo Hill.
Relations between Burma and Norway haven't always been good. Oslo was a strident critic of the former military regime under Generals Ne Win and Than Shwe. The Norwegian capital provided the birthplace of the Democratic Voice of Burma, which began broadcasting radio programs 20 years ago as a counterpoint to the strict censorship of media inside Burma. Oslo is also the home of the Nobel Peace Prize, which honoured Burma's democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi in 1991. Sean Turnell is Associate Professor in Economics at Sydney's Macquarie University and a long-time Burma observer.
Norway's connection to Burma is very deep and very prolonged, but up until now it's mostly been concerned with the democracy movement.
Norway was among several Western nations that moved to drop sanctions against Burma in the wake of the political and economic reforms made over the past 2 years, led by Thein Sein. Sean Turnell says while there are still many in Norway that need to be convinced of progress in Burma, President Thein Sein's visit will not be all about political outreach.
I think there won't be a lot of convincing. I think many countries are sort of falling over themselves at the moment to go into Burma and conduct scoping missions and to sort of re-establish relations.
Bjorn Tonsberg is from Wilhelmsen's Ships Service in Singapore. The Norwegian businessman was also part of a business delegation that visited Burma or Myanmar last year as sanctions were eased.
I think that Myanmar today is what I would call the darling of the Western world, and I think that a lot of Western companies, including Norwegian companies, would be very interested to go in there, do a market study, and based on that decide whether or not this market is a good market for them to invest in.
Bjorn Tonsberg says his maritime product supply company withdrew from Burma when international sanctions were placed on the country in the early 1990s, which he admits put Wilhelmsen behind the competition.
We left and certain of them didn't, so we, in a way, have to gear up and get in there and start rebuilding our image in the local marketplace.
Burma economics analyst Sean Turnell says it's more companies like this from beyond Burma's neighbourhood, including China and Southeast Asia, that President Thein Sein is hoping to attract during this week's Europe trip.
This new government, part of the whole reason that they engaged on this reform process is basically to diversify. He'd probably be just trying to reassure some of those countries that Burma's reform program will continue to be rolled out and that the country may at some time become a reliable place for investment.
This week, listeners to the Voice of America and BBC World Service English programs heard something very different. First, the Voice of America. At the same time, there was also the same kind of interference, but targeting the BBC World Service. Well, that was the sound of jamming against the BBC World Service and the Voice of America. Now, jamming against these two broadcasters is nothing new. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union and some Eastern European countries would jam VOA and BBC broadcasts. But the broadcasts they would jam would either be in Russian, Polish, or Ukrainian, or other languages spoken in Eastern Europe. The BBC and VOA Chinese program, Tibetan, Uyghur, and other languages spoken in China is being jammed today. But what is unusual is jamming against programming in English, especially on frequencies that are not even targeted towards China. Beginning in late December last year, many listeners started noticing a very strange sound on the shortwave dial. But this month, it increased. Frequencies that have never been jammed before in English are now finally being jammed. And like I said, these are frequencies that are not even targeting China. They could be targeting other parts of the world or Southeast Asia or wherever. To find out more about this, we contacted Victor Gunatelika in Sri Lanka, who works as a monitor.
We started noticing somewhere late December, but not on a particular station, but the strange sounds suddenly started popping up on the high frequencies. So it would move. They were as if somebody was testing, but we thought, okay, it's some strange noise, something domestic, something in the home or whatever, because it was not on a regular frequency. But as you say, I really noticed on the 14th, exactly on the 14th of February, the day the State of the Union message was being transmitted by the BBC on 15310. By the way, BOA did not carry it. They closed down at 200 hours UTC. And I was on BBC 15310. And I did have quite a tough time right through, not like before, where it would keep moving up and down the band. So I felt that there was something deliberate going on. But on a one-off, you can't decide on that. Well, quite a few of us who are in the monitoring business have been watching things, checking out and all that. And finally, it has now been definitely established that it's deliberate jamming. And I've been taking some measurements from my location here in Colombo with my log periodic beam antenna and taking propagation as well. I can put it down to China. Somewhere in China, I wouldn't say a pinpoint exactly, but it's definitely China. Another candidate that people have been floating around suggesting would be Iran. But definitely I can put my money that it's not in Iran, taking the propagation and the frequency use. So 14th February is the day that I really noticed the severity of jamming.
And what's interesting, Victor, and we were talking about this earlier, is the jamming of frequencies is very selective. Now, for example, in the morning hours, morning here in Asia and Southeast Asia, the Voice of America have a number of English transmissions. There are those in special English. Those are not affected at all. The programs that, for me, when I tried to listen today, that were affected were the general regular program from the VOA. The special English programs were fine.
Well, it appears at this time, it appears that there is very selective jamming, and they are going for the news broadcasts and the current affairs programs, not so much, as you say, the special English broadcasts. So it appears to be a very selective jamming at this stage. And as you rightly put it, our observations have been that they are probably the frequencies that are best heard within China. And you mentioned an interesting point that during the height of the Cold War, even, for instance, the Soviet Union never jammed the English broadcast. Well, Heath, we are talking about almost 25 years after the peak of that. And I was just going through some figures. And there are 750 million new English speakers or people who are trying to learn English. So today's English is more or less a very important language with the internet, interactive computers. And I think China probably has realized the importance of English getting through to their people. So that may be just an idea.
Well, you know, it is highly unusual. And as I posted on Facebook, and we were also just talking about this a moment ago, I said, you know, if I was, let's say, at the Broadcasting Board of Governors or in the UK at the Foreign Office, and I started seeing these reports that they're jamming programs in English, my thinking would be, well, they're jamming English on shortwave? That's unusual. Well, maybe there are people listening.
Yeah, definitely. There are people listening, Keith. There's no doubt about it. Because, I mean, what's my alternative? Local placements? Hardly any. And the only other alternative would be streaming. When I have an internet connection for which I pay quite a pricey amount, and even the download speed is so weak, so slow, I can tell you, I rarely go onto the internet streaming to listen to something unless I have missed something very important, which I try to get downloaded from archives. So people are listening. One reason why people might think that they are not listening is that some of the international broadcasters, notably in the West, they have been cutting down on transmitters. Even now, I know, for instance, the Voice of America has 500 kilowatt transmitters, but they are running at 250 kilowatts. So now I think it's the time, if you want to beat the jammer, at least you have to increase your signal, because that's what I have experienced here. With a small portable radio, I get a real hard time trying to beat the jammer. But when I use an external antenna, well, the jammer to signal noise level, strength level is favoring me to receive my signal. So we have to meet this jamming situation. I don't know whether the West is prepared to spend that much money, but there are thousands and millions of listeners all over the world who would like to have a better signal to beat the jamming as such.
Now, one of the things that used to be done during the Cold War, the 70s and 80s, in particular to the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, was that when the Soviets would jam, the VOA and Radio Free Europe would just turn around and put more frequencies on the air. Do you see that happening now? Do you see the BBC and the VOA, for example, adding more frequencies on the air?
Well, the decision is theirs. If they want to get people to listen, there's a new challenge. You have to come up with something. Use frequencies in such a way that propagationally it's not possible to jam it effectively, and also increase the number of transmitters available to the listener. So there's no other way, alternative way. Increase your signal and give more options. We have noticed that the Chinese appear at this moment to be using 3 or 4 transmitters. That's all they seem to be using at the moment at peak hours. So if the Western broadcasters can increase the frequencies, the transmitters that they are dedicating to shortwave broadcasting, I think we can get through this problem. Whether they'll do it or not, I don't know, Keith.
Now, Radio Australia's Chinese service and some of their hours in English have also been affected, and I can hear it in this part of East Asia. And I heard there are unconfirmed reports that even some or one frequency from All India Radio is having the same interference. Can you confirm that, or was this just talk and gossip?
Oh, no, I haven't monitored it myself, but I have very reliable information from one of the top monitors in the region that 2 of All India Radio's transmissions have been jammed, especially when there isn't a heavy concentration of VOA and BBC. So as I said again, it appears at this time that only about 3 or 4 transmitters are being dedicated to the jamming effort. It might expand, I don't know, but at the moment, All India Radio is definitely being jammed on 2 frequencies at a time when it appears that they have the jammers have the transmitters available.
Victor Gunatelica speaking to us from Sri Lanka on the unusual jamming against VOA and BBC World Service English programming. Next, let me ask you 2 questions. First, are you interested in photography? Or rather, have you ever been interested in photography? Next question, do you like to travel? What are some of the places that you'd like to go to? Vietnam, Burma, Malaysia, Cambodia? Well, imagine taking a photography course and being able to visit these very exotic countries. Well, that's exactly what's being done and organized by 2 guys from Singapore, Simon Taplin, who's worked as a commercial photographer for more than 20 years, and Alan Tam, who runs a photography school. I recently spoke to them over Skype. Now, before we got into what this course is, I wanted to find out a little bit more about how their interest in photography all started.
For me, like anyone, it's you're inspired, I guess, by your parents. My mother was in film production, and she used to take me on film sets. And as a young child, well, I was just awe-inspired by all the lights and the big cameras, and that's where my interest began. And she bought me my first camera, and I started taking pictures, I guess, from about the age 14 years old. So it's been an interesting journey for me. It's been, I've had this cusp of the traditional film, which is my grounding, my technical grounding, and then I've transitioned through the digital ages. And it's interesting to see now that there's actually a resurgence back in film processes and alternative processes now, because people are losing that very tactile image of printing and that intense, that kind of suspense of not knowing what's on your film and then, you know, waiting for your film to come back and then printing it out organically. It's been lost in the digital age. You know, they're just stored on our hard drives, they're stored on our thumb drives, and they're not displayed. So there's a very big resurgence now in all processes. It's very interesting.
For me, you know, just like what Simon said, you're always inspired by your parents, of course, except me. My dad was a butcher. So, you know, I didn't want to get inspired to, you know, to be cutting meat and stuff like that, you know. I want my hand to be clean. And I'm always into art. And I only realized that I'm into art I'm good at it when I was a kid. You know, looking at my siblings who could draw really well. And I actually imitated a drawing from scrap paper. And I actually drew stuff imitating what it did on, you know, the other page of the paper. And eventually, you know, when my sibling saw the drawing, they couldn't believe it was done by me. That's because I was only six and everything looked so lifelike looking. And then eventually, around the same time, I found a camera in the kitchen, in the cabinet, because of my height. I was really tiny, so I was the only one could find a camera. And I didn't know what that was, except that it was my toy. And then eventually when I found that basically it's very similar to drawing, except they're using light. I grew liking what a camera could do to simulate what any kind of artist could do, which is, you know, drawing except using light. So yeah, then I pick up photography seriously from there on. That's how it is, and the rest is history.
Now, the two of you have sort of combined traveling, tourism, and photography together. This is, of course, a very interesting thing to do. I don't think it has been done it probably has been done in other parts of the world before. But where was your inspiration to do this? How did you come about? Were you just, say, traveling, let's say, to Cambodia and said, you know, we should organize tours and of amateur photographers and, you know, teach classes on the go, so to speak?
Well, actually, it was a sequence of coincidences, really. People have been telling me for a number of years, oh, you should go into education, you should go into training. I've been shooting professionally now for nearly 20 years, and I've been shooting for commercial clients quite a lot. And basically, you're kind of just executing a creative's visual. One day I just said, you know, I want to do something for myself. I want to refine myself, because 20 years of commercial photography, as I said, you're just acting out something. You're not actually really creating something from your own heart. And part of education was to go into a discovery process for myself. And I was thinking, okay, I was assessing all the training products on the market, and they were very much very online training. And I said, well, why don't we take training to beautiful locations? And I could see that there was a need for people want to spend their money differently these days. They want to spend their money on something meaningful, a holiday where they come back with something, that they've learned something and they've enjoyed something. So our courses, we teach a basic foundation course in photography. And again, it's a lifestyle holiday, so it's not too taxing. We both have an ability to kind of explain technical or distill technical know-hows into easy-to-understand analogies. So it's not a taxing course, but you get to experience a new country, you get to stay in a wonderful hotel, and you get to learn something. And we have a sustainability program that we give back to the community. So, you know, when you come on a course with us, we're putting money back into microfinancing projects, healthcare, education, and teaching the locals how to take pictures as well for themselves. So anyway, so I'm jumping the gun a little bit. Alan's been in training for a number of years now and runs a very successful school, the Singapore School of Photography in Singapore. And I phoned him up just to pick his brains, basically, about training. And it so transpired that he had the same vision as well about doing these lifestyle destination courses. So he was doing groundwork as well. So we met up on a few occasions and we talked, and and then we... we decided to kind of like collaborate, using both of our skills and putting them together.
Now, the both of you are located in Singapore, which is, of course, very close to places like Vietnam, Cambodia, Burma, Laos, Thailand, Philippines, Malaysia, of course, and India and Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. How do you decide on where you want to go?
Our first course is Cambodia. And we very much like Cambodia because it's has a very diverse spectrum of locations to photograph. You have the wonderful temples of Angkor, which are absolutely stunning.
Which is one of the seven wonders of the world.
Yeah, and then you have floating villages on stilts. Just a short drive out of Siem Reap, you're in the countryside. It's just such a colorful location to photograph. Basically Asia is our studio. There's so many wonderful locations out here. That's why we decided to focus our training courses on Asia. It's just a world of opportunity. It's our outdoor studio. Now Burma's opening up. That's going to be very interesting. We're planning our next course in Burma. It's fantastic. It's just such a colorful location. That's why, we're focusing on Asia as our studio.
Yeah.
What could be better?
Alan, let me ask you, I mean, you have a photography school in Singapore. What are the kind of students that you get? Are they people that, let's say, that just want to learn more about it, or they want to become professional photographers? Because from what I've seen so far, there are a lot of photographers everywhere.
The kind of students that we have, basically, they're from all over the world. So we have students from as far as South Africa, Venezuela, from China, even Oman. So, you know, you name it, we might have it. But the level of the knowledge that they have, again, is quite a broad spectrum too. We have people who just want to know how to use a camera so that they could take pictures of their son's wedding next weekend. Mm-hmm. And we have professional photographer who want to strengthen their foundations, and so we cater for all kind of people. But the important thing, it's really not just own a good camera, but know what you do with the tool. Then you could produce all kind of stuff that you want, and that's what we do. That's what we provide. We make sure that you have a very strong foundations.
Now, let's say, for example, I went to the two of you and I said, look, I know you're doing this trip to Cambodia. What can I expect on it?
You can expect a world of discovery, make new friends, learn new skills, new bonds.
Learn the culture.
New culture. I mean, as soon as you arrive in the airport, I mean, we've arranged transportation via tuk-tuk. which is to awaken your senses to the wonders of Cambodia. So you're not going to be picked up in a coach bus or a fancy limousine. Oh, you can have a limousine if you want, but we want to experience the real Cambodia, the sights, the smells, the sounds. So that's our welcoming experience. So
it sounds like, for example, by doing that, you're trying to put everybody, say, in the right spirit and the right mood to go there and be able to photograph it. Because, I mean, for example, like myself, if I got on a flight and went to Cambodia and I went to the historic areas, I would just take pictures and that was it. But I think you're trying to do more than that, correct?
Yes, it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle. It's a learning experience. It's making a positive difference to the community that you're visiting by giving back. So it's a whole holistic approach to photography courses. It's not just about learning the basic foundations of photography. It's a whole, I repeat again, a whole holistic experience.
Yeah. At the same time, think about this. You can do travel without photography. You know, when you travel to a place, you would definitely hope that you bring back some very nice pictures back home. A lot of time, you could have a very nice camera, but by the time you get home and you look at the pictures, you'd be like, oh, you know, I wish I could have done better. But it's not a place that you could wake up tomorrow and go back there again. Imagine, you know, another country really far away. So this is going to be a really good trip because you go to that destination, it's not just to sightseeing and take pictures, but you learn exactly how to produce the pictures you want in a very proper way. What I mean by proper way is if you're able to visualize what you want, you were able to achieve it. So that is foundation of in photography. So once you're able to do that, then you know you make the best use of your entire trip. You go there sightseeing, learn the culture, at the same time able to produce pictures that you want and come back, be really happy and satisfied with what you have captured.
And that was my conversation with Alan Lim and Simon Taplin, who've started organizing photography courses that involve travel. Their first one is going to be to Cambodia. If you want more information, you can check out the website for this show and you'll find a link to them, which is www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Well, now we're out of time. I must leave you right now. If you wish to contact us, our email address is, as always, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.